Walters Clark in 1783. "I am afraid," Jefferson had written of the British and the West, "that they have some thoughts of colonizing into that quarter." The time was right for the exploratory journey Jefferson had long pondered. He wanted to find a route to the Pacific and limn the contours of a West that might well become a theater of contention between the United States and imperial powers. To lead the enterprise, Jefferson did not look far, choosing Meriwether Lewis, his private secretary. Born in 1774 at Locust Hill, 10 miles from Monticello, Lewis came from what Jefferson called his own neighborhood. Bold and blue-eyed, young Lewis had been a lieutenant in the U.S. Army, serving under James Wilkinson, when Jefferson asked him to come to Washington to serve in the President's House in 1801. Impressed with Lewis's knowledge of the Western country, of the Army and its situation, Jefferson apparently drew on Lewis's sense of the officer corps as the President evaluated the military he had inherited from John Adams. Jefferson trusted Lewis and admired his hardiness, and after Congress secretly agreed to fund an expedition to find the best route to the Pacific, asked him to lead it. The President asked for and received $2,500. The final bill came in at about 15 times that amount. "Captain Lewis is brave, prudent, habituated to the woods, and familiar with Indian manners and character," Jefferson told Benjamin Rush. Lewis asked William Clark, George Rogers Clark's brother, to join him in organizing what became known as the Corps of Volunteers for Northwest Discovery. Jefferson thought of America as an empire of liberty. Now he would have a keener, more detailed grasp of the continent that stretched far beyond the nation's existing borders, and a chance at claiming that sprawling West. Chapter 34. Victories, Scandal, and a Secret Sickness. "By this wench, Sally, our president has had several children. There is not an individual in the neighborhood of Charlottesville who does not believe the story, and not a few who know it." James Callender, The Richmond Recorder, September 1802. There had been a time, not so very long ago, that Jefferson believed he could, if not end, then transcend partisanship. It was an ideal of the age. The concept of party was viewed with fear and suspicion. The great George Washington himself had warned against partisan spirit in his farewell address. The warning did no good, and Jefferson's hopes of enduring political unity were never to be realized. In early 1801, even before Jefferson declared that Americans were all Federalists and all Republicans in his inaugural address, Albert Gallatin reported the reality on the ground in the Capitol. "You may suppose that being thrown together in a few boarding houses, without any other society than ourselves, we are not likely to be either very moderate politicians or to think of anything but politics." Federalist Simeon Baldwin shared the sentiment, writing, "The men of the different parties do not associate intimately." Yet another observer said, "No tavern or boarding house contains two members of opposite sentiments." Jefferson did try. "Nothing shall be spared on my part to obliterate the traces of party and consolidate the nation, if it can be done without abandonment of principle," he said in March 1801. 34 months later, after the partisan wars of his first term, he struck more practical notes, accepting the world as it was. "The attempt at reconciliation was honorably pursued by us for a year or two, and spurned by them," he said. As Jefferson well knew, in practice, the best he could hope for was a truce between himself and his opponents, not a permanent peace. Political divisions were intrinsic. What mattered most was how a president managed those divisions. Jefferson's strategy was sound. Believing in the promise of democratic republicanism, and in his own capacity for transformative leadership, he took a broad view. "There is nothing to which a nation is not equal, where it pours all its energies and zeal into the hands of those to whom they confide the direction of their force." He proposed a covenant. "Let us meet the political challenges of the country together and try to restrain the passions that led to the extremist apocalyptic rhetoric of what Jefferson called the gloomy days of terrorism of the 1790s, and perhaps politics could become a means of progress, not simply a source of conflict. The prevailing Federalist view was that such a covenant was lovely to talk about, but impossible to bring into being. John Quincy Adams was right when he told his diary that political war was to be the rule, not the exception, in American life. The country is so totally given up to the spirit of party that not to follow blindfold the one or the other is an inexpiable offense, Adams wrote during Jefferson's first term. The founders' dream of a nation beyond partisanship was one that simply could not survive the very nature of a free politics in a culture of diverse interests. Republican or Federalist, to anyone who bothered to pay attention, there was no mystery about Jefferson's agenda in the Capitol. Mr. Jefferson doesn't at all hesitate to say that the previous administration conducted itself under anti-Republican maxims, the French envoy Louis-André Pichon reported home to Paris, and the new president was determined to correct such inequalities and errors. Jefferson was relentless in pursuing and putting down threats to his vision of a Republican nation. Whether they were Federalist judges and other officeholders, including the Chief Justice of the United States, or hostile newspapermen, Jefferson's foes faced spirited challenges from the president's house. By virtue of the Republican successes in the 1800 presidential and congressional elections, Jefferson had the strength to do largely as he wished. He had made his essential views known. Candidates for the House and the Senate had made their support for him and for those views clear as well. A majority of the voting population wanted to move on from the federalism of the 1790s, and Jefferson was ready to lead the way. The Federalists had a lot to say, but their words were no match for what the president had, the votes. The new Judiciary Act of 1802 was a monument to Jefferson's power. The 1801 Act was a Federalist bid to protect the faction from popular reaction by giving lifetime tenure to the like-minded. The 1802 bill, written and passed by Jefferson's Republicans, sought to break the Federalist hold on the judiciary. On one side stood Federalists arguing that the courts, including courts created only months before, were sacrosanct. On the other stood Jefferson and his followers, asserting that no branch of government could rightly lie beyond the reach of reform. The principles at stake were self-evident. So were the political realities. Though Jefferson proceeded with caution, there were no declarations of war on the judiciary, he did proceed. In Jefferson's first annual message in December 1801, he dryly wrote that the judicial system of the United States, and especially that portion of it recently erected, will, of course, present itself to the contemplation of Congress. Behind those seemingly benign words lay a presidential determination that the Republicans in Congress would strike against the new judgeships created by the 1801 Act. The repeal passed on Monday, March 8, 1802. The House vote reflected the Republican advantage in the lower chamber. In the Senate, the bill succeeded by a single vote, but it succeeded. Then in April, the Congress approved a new Judiciary Act of 1802. Among other aspects, the bill, which Jefferson signed into law, eliminated the new circuit judgeships that had come into being in the last phase of the Adams administration. It was an enormous victory for Jefferson, and the Federalists were horrified. Jefferson's hatred of his cousin John Marshall was cordial, but it was hatred nonetheless. The judge's inveteracy is profound, and his mind of that gloomy malignity which will never let him forego the opportunity of satiating it on a victim, Jefferson once wrote. In February 1803, the Chief Justice issued the opinion of the Supreme Court in the case of Marbury v. Madison, a confrontation between one of John Adams's midnight appointees, William Marbury, and the Jefferson administration. The decision, which held that Madison had been wrong to withhold Marbury's commission, went against the president, but Marshall wisely avoided a showdown while helping lay the foundations for the concept of judicial review. U.S. Judge John Pickering of New Hampshire, meanwhile, was the object of impeachment in the House in the winter of 1803, as was Supreme Court Associate Justice Samuel Chase. Pickering was unstable, a drinker, who may have been insane. His impeachment and conviction were of less ultimate moment than the effort against Chase, who had given the Republicans an opening with a provocative charge to a grand jury in Baltimore, and who had been openly hostile to Jefferson's party. Where law is uncertain, partial, or arbitrary, where justice is not impartially administered to all, where property is insecure, and the person is liable to insult and violence without redress by law, the people are not free, whatever may be their form of government, Chase said in May 1803. He attacked the repeal of the Judiciary Act of 1801, telling the Baltimore jury, "Our Republican Constitution will sink into a mobocracy, the worst of all possible governments." Infuriated by Chase's diatribe, one issued from the sanctuary of the bench, Jefferson wrote Maryland Congressman Joseph H. Nicholson, who had recently brought charges against Judge Pickering. "Ought this seditious and official attack on the principles of our Constitution and on the proceedings of a state to go unpunished? And to whom so pointedly as yourself will the public look for the necessary measures?" In conclusion, Jefferson noted, "I ask these questions for your consideration. For myself, it is better that I should not interfere." Except, of course, that he just had interfered. It was a characteristic Jeffersonian tactic, instigating a course of action from afar. Ultimately, the Senate convicted John Pickering, and the House impeached Samuel Chase, who won an acquittal from the Senate on Friday before Jefferson's second inauguration in 1805. The failure to remove Chase from office has long been interpreted as a defeat for Jefferson, but the president's point was made. Judges who, in John Randolph's phrase, played the part of an electioneering partisan, were not safe from censure of some kind. The Federalist judiciary was on notice. Such successes drove Jefferson's enemies mad. One correspondent wrote to the president of hopes that Your Excellency might be beheaded within 1 year. An anonymous letter from New York told Jefferson that the writer, who signed himself a Federalist Democrat, had been asked to go to Washington and then assassinate you. 12 days later came another letter from New York, this one signed A.X., saying, "You are in danger. A dreadful plot is forming against you. Julius Caesar was cautioned for the Ides of March. I caution you for the last of April." In victory, Jefferson moved carefully on the politically treacherous issue of federal appointments. The composition of the government was among the key questions to challenge the newly inaugurated president, and the newly inaugurated president's hope to lead a less divided nation. How many Federalist officeholders should be removed and replaced with Republicans? Jefferson's Republican allies were pushing for aggressive action. An energetic tone towards the leaders of the Royalist Party will keep the Republicans and new converts together and gain strength daily to your administration, Monroe had written Jefferson 8 days after the inaugural in 1801. Jefferson replied that he hoped the spell of the late 1790s had broken, and that the Federalist manipulation of the XYZ affair and other supposed threats to the nation had come to be seen as manufactured. At length, the poor arts of tub plots, etc., were repeated till the designs of the party became suspected. The tub plots reference was from the English Civil War, when forged evidence of a 1679 conspiracy to keep James, the Catholic Duke of York, from the throne was found in a tub of meal. Jefferson's evocation of the episode in the context of the 1790s shows that he continued to view history partly through the prism of the wars and conflicts of the 17th century, a time of conspiracy, intrigue, and perpetual tension between monarchists and republicans. Believing the American people essentially sound and aware of the Federalist excesses, Jefferson favored a moderate tone. "We must be easy with them," he said of the Federalists, but he did not fail to take decisive action. Scholarly estimates put Jefferson's removal rate quite high. He displaced about 46% of incumbent officeholders in 1801, the strong majority of whom were Federalists. Such a rate places Jefferson in the historical company of Andrew Jackson, whose removals 3 decades later shocked establishment sensibilities. Jefferson was especially hard on Adams's last-minute decisions. One of Adams's midnight appointments was that of Eleazar Goodrich to the collectorship of the port at New Haven. The post had fallen open only in February 1801. Responding to Republican sentiment in Connecticut, Jefferson removed Goodrich and appointed Samuel Bishop, the mayor of New Haven, to his place. A group of merchants in New Haven issued a remonstrance against Goodrich's removal, prompting Jefferson to lay out his thinking on federal appointments. Declarations by myself in favor of political tolerance, exhortations to harmony and affection in social intercourse, and to respect for the equal rights of the minority, have on certain occasions been quoted and misconstrued into assurances that the tenure of offices was to be undisturbed. But, Jefferson went on, is it political intolerance to claim a proportionate share in the direction of the public affairs? Can they not harmonize in society unless they have everything in their own hands? He was pragmatic. He could see the whole. He understood that removals like the one in New Haven would produce political discord, but that was the nature of the enterprise. As were scathing newspaper attacks. Thomas McCain of Pennsylvania, the governor who had been so forthright in his support for Jefferson in the 1800 election, felt that the partisan papers in his state were abusing their freedom of expression, and he was weighing whether to take legal action. The infamous and seditious libels published almost daily in our newspapers are become intolerable, McCain wrote Jefferson in February 1803. If they cannot be altogether prevented, they may be greatly checked by a few prosecutions. Jefferson replied carefully but clearly. On the subject of prosecutions, what I say must be entirely confidential, for you know the passion for torturing every sentiment and word which comes from me, Jefferson wrote McCain on Saturday, February 19, 1803. I have long thought that a few prosecutions of the most eminent offenders would have a wholesome effect in restoring the integrity of the presses. Not a general prosecution, for that would look like persecution, but a selected one. Most newspapers, however, were out of reach, including James Callender's. On Wednesday, September 1, 1802, in the Richmond Recorder, Callender had his revenge on Jefferson, publishing an account of the Jefferson-Sally Hemings relationship. It is well known that the man, whom it delighteth the people to honor, keeps, and for many years past has kept, as his concubine, one of his own slaves. Her name is Sally. The name of her eldest son is Tom. His features are said to bear a striking, although sable, resemblance to those of the president himself. The boy is 10 or 12 years of age. His mother went to France in the same vessel with Mr. Jefferson and his two daughters. The delicacy of this arrangement must strike every person of common sensibility. What a sublime pattern for an American ambassador to place before the eyes of two young ladies. By this wench, Sally, our president has had several children. There is not an individual in the neighborhood of Charlottesville who does not believe the story, and not a few who know it. Behold the favorite, the firstborn of republicanism, the pinnacle of all that is good and great. In the open consummation of an act which tends to subvert the policy, the happiness, and even the existence of this country. 'Tis supposed that, at the time when Mr. Jefferson wrote so smartly concerning Negroes, when he endeavored so much to belittle the African race, he had no expectation that the chief magistrate of the United States was to be the ringleader in showing that his opinion was erroneous, or that he should choose an African stock whereupon he was to engraft his own descendants. We give it to the world under the firmest belief that such a refutation never can be made. The African Venus is said to officiate as housekeeper at Monticello. When Mr. Jefferson has read this article, he will find leisure to estimate how much has been lost or gained by so many unprovoked attacks upon J.T. Callender. Callender had many of his facts right, and he corrected those he missed. He later noted, for instance, that Hemings had traveled with Polly alone, and not with Jefferson and Patsy. The license that has been indulged against the president has exhausted its violence in revealing some very old so-called liaisons between him and one of his slaves, Pichon reported to Paris. Jefferson never directly responded to the charge. Historians have long taken an 1805 letter as an implicit denial. In that note, he said that the allegations about his courtship of the married Betsy Walker was the only allegation against him that was true. It is possible, though, that Jefferson was not addressing the Hemings allegations at all in that letter, which included a now-lost enclosure, presumably a clipping or copy of Federalist attacks on Jefferson's character. Without the enclosure, we cannot know for certain that he was denying the Hemings story, only that the enclosure mentioned the Walker affair and some other alleged transgressions. In any event, the charges remained in wide circulation during his lifetime and afterward. Callender and Sally will be remembered as long as Jefferson, as blots on his character, John Adams wrote privately. The story of the latter is a natural and almost unavoidable consequence of that foul contagion in the human character, Negro slavery. Soon Callender was found drowned in 3 feet of water in the James River on a day when he had been observed wandering drunkenly through Richmond. The inquest discovered no evidence of foul play. It was a pathetic end to a tragic life. In 1806, Thomas Moore, an Irish poet, published verses mentioning the rumors about Jefferson and Sally Hemings. The weary statesman for repose hath fled from halls of council to his negroes' shed, where, blessed, he woos some black Aspasia's grace and dreams of freedom in his slave's embrace. Patsy and a former Jefferson secretary, William A. Burwell, showed the obnoxious passages to Jefferson, who laughed them off, effectively ending a discussion before one could begin. So far as we know, no one else in Jefferson's family or official circle ever raised the Sally Hemings question with him except to denounce any discussion of it in the public press as reprehensible. For Jefferson, the code of silence on the issue of sex across the color line appears to have been total. In December 1801, Jefferson had obliquely confided in Benjamin Rush about something else entirely, his physical well-being. "My health has always been so uniformly firm that I have for some years dreaded nothing so much as living too long," Jefferson wrote. "I think, however, that a flaw has appeared which ensures me against that." He went into no detail, adding only that secrecy about any such question was essential. "I have said as much to no mortal breathing," Jefferson added, "and my florid health is calculated to keep my friends as well as foes quiet, as they should be." After Rush pressed his friend for specifics, Jefferson provided them. The complaint was diarrhea, a serious illness of the day. In his Medical Lexicon, a dictionary of medical science, Dr. Robley Dunglison, who was to attend Jefferson at the time of his death a quarter century later, described diarrhea as a disease characterized by frequent liquid evacuations and generally owing to inflammation or irritation of the mucous membrane of the intestines. It could be acute or chronic, and in some cases fatal, because, like hectic fever, it seems to obtain habitual possession of the constitution to operate upon it with scarcely any perceptible intermission, and in general to defy the most powerful remedies. The affliction would trouble Jefferson for the rest of his life. His family came to Washington for Christmas 1802. Patsy and Polly were together. Margaret Bayard Smith spent a good deal of time with them both. "Mrs. Epps is beautiful, simplicity and timidity personified when in company, but when alone with you, of communicative and winning manners," Mrs. Smith wrote. "Mrs. Randolph is rather homely, a delicate likeness of her father, but still more interesting than Mrs. Epps. She is really one of the most lovely women I have ever met with, her countenance beaming with intelligence, benevolence, and sensibility, and her conversation fulfills all her countenance promises. Her manners, so frank and affectionate, that you know her at once and feel perfectly at your ease with her. Patsy," Mrs. Smith continued, "gave me an account of all her children, of the character of her husband, and many family anecdotes. She has that rare but charming egotism which can interest the listener in all one's concerns." It was a busy season. "I have only time to write a line to you, my dearest husband. The incessant round of company we are in, scarcely allowing time to dress to receive them," Polly wrote her husband, John Wales Epps. "I am at this moment writing whilst waiting for a gown to be smoothed, though the drawing-room is full of ladies. The visitors from Virginia were struck by Jefferson's lonely accommodations. "Adieu once more," Polly wrote to Jefferson in January 1803. "How much I think of you at the hours which we have been accustomed to be with you alone, my dear papa, and how much pain it gives me to think of the unsafe and solitary manner in which you sleep upstairs." Jefferson set about acquiring the proper furniture to provide fitting bedrooms for his large family on future visits. He loved it when everyone was there. A caller once observed the president sitting on the drawing-room floor in the midst of grandchildren, so eagerly and noisily engaged in a game of romps that the visitor went unnoticed for a moment. "I will catch you in bed on Sunday or Monday morning," Jefferson jovially wrote to a granddaughter before a visit. From Monticello, Patsy wrote about her control over the house with a firmness that must have pleased her father. "I have wrought an entire reformation on the household," she told Jefferson. "Nothing comes in or goes out without my knowledge, and I believe there is as little waste as possible. I visit the kitchen smokehouse and fowls when the weather permits, and according to your desire, saw the meat cut out." There was still some hope of Jefferson's having a small family with him in Washington. Both John Wales Epps and Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. were seeking congressional seats. If either or both won, they would come to live with Jefferson in the president's house. In the event, they were both elected. Despite all, the attacks from Callender, the toll of governing, the loneliness in the mansion, Jefferson liked being president. He was driven by a need to secure the republic from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Most leaders can only hope to shape their nation for a brief time. In the middle of 1803, a report from Paris would give Jefferson the power to transform his for all time. Chapter 35. The Air of Enchantment. The news of the cession of Louisiana forms an era in our history, and of itself must render the administration of Jefferson immortal. Samuel Harrison Smith. The fame of your political wisdom is now so permanently established that it is past the power of a disappointed faction ever to diminish it. Horatio Gates, on learning of the Louisiana Purchase. Before his first month as president was done, Jefferson received reports of rumors in London that Spain had signed a treaty giving France more than half of her North American colonies. Known as the Third Treaty of San Ildefonso, the agreement had been reached in a glorious 18th-century palace north of Madrid, favored as a hunting retreat by Castilian kings. The arrangement, negotiated in late 1800, gave France ownership of the Spanish territory of Louisiana in the New World. The cession, as it was called, works most sorely on the U.S., Jefferson wrote in April 1802. It completely reverses all the political relations of the U.S. and will form a new epoch in our political course. Napoleon now had a vast interest in and on the American continent. "I am willing to hope, as long as anybody will hope with me, that the reports were wrong," Jefferson said. They were not wrong. Jefferson understood he needed to act, but act subtly. "I believe that the destinies of great countries depend on it," he wrote the French economist Pierre-Samuel Dupont de Nemours. To Jefferson, it was an existential matter. "There is on the globe one single spot, the possessor of which is our natural and habitual enemy. It is New Orleans, through which the produce of 3/8 of our territory must pass to market, and from its fertility it will ere long yield more than half of our whole produce and contain more than half our inhabitants." In a conversation of some length with the British diplomat Edward Thornton in Washington, Jefferson said that the occupation of this country by France gave an entirely new character to all American relations with her. Jefferson was not sanguine. "The inevitable consequences of such a neighborhood," Thornton recorded Jefferson saying, "must be jealousy, irritation, and finally, hostilities." As frightening as the moment was, Jefferson approached it with confidence. The success of his first year in office buoyed him for the struggle with Napoleon. The story of the Louisiana Purchase is one of strength, of Jefferson's adaptability, and most important, his determination to secure the territory from France, doubling the size of the country and transforming the United States into a continental power. A slower or less courageous politician might have bungled the acquisition. An overly idealistic one might have lost it by insisting on strict constitutional scruples. Jefferson, however, was neither slow nor weak, nor overly idealistic. He drew on a lifetime of political experience, of victories and defeats, to manage the Louisiana crisis. He knew he needed to control the mechanics of decision as best he could, in this case by sending his own envoy, James Monroe, to Paris, a lesson learned in Williamsburg during the Stamp Act debates. He knew he needed to communicate in a way to rally the public, a lesson learned in 1774 when writing the Day of Fasting and Prayer Resolution, and again in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence. Most important, he knew he needed to seize the initiative when he could, a lesson learned in his days as governor during the Revolution. Now that Napoleon was in the picture, Jefferson understood what had to be done. The day that France takes possession of New Orleans, we must marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation. With national interests at stake, Jefferson was willing to shift his sympathies from Paris to London, or at least be seen that way to improve America's negotiating power. Jefferson was clear-eyed. The fading Spanish Empire had been one thing. Napoleonic France was quite another. France, placing herself in that door, assumes to us the attitude of defiance, Jefferson said. Spain might have retained it quietly for years. Not so can it ever be in the hands of France. The impetuosity of her temper, the energy and restlessness of her character, placed in a point of eternal friction with us, render it impossible that France and the U.S. can continue long friends when they meet in so irritable a position. The session was rumored but not confirmed until February 1802, when a copy of a subsequent treaty of Aranjuez reached Washington, sent by Rufus King, the American minister to Britain. In a letter written just before he left the United States for France, Pierre S. Dupont gave Jefferson a tutorial on the practicalities of power. Most important, America should not offend or threaten Napoleon. Among the issues for Europe was the fear that the United States had designs on Spanish-held Mexico. The question came to this: how then do you intend to acquire Louisiana and persuade France to surrender its ownership in an amicable way? Alas, Mr. President, contractual freedom and a natural taste for wealth in all nations and all individuals — poverty strikes all great powers, and only second-rate powers escape it — leave you with only one alternative, since you have no land to trade. It is financed purchase. Jefferson could not go to France himself, and so he reached out to a trusted friend. The President and James Madison weighed the possibilities, and, in what Dolly Madison called a most important piece of political business, decided to ask their fellow Virginian, James Monroe, to travel to France as a presidential envoy. In this situation, we are obliged to call on you for a temporary sacrifice of yourself to prevent this greatest of evils in the present prosperous tide of our affairs, Jefferson wrote Monroe, who agreed to the assignment. A snowstorm and unfavorable winds delayed Monroe's departure, and he took advantage of the unexpected time on his hands to write Jefferson about the politics of his mission. I hope the French government will have wisdom enough to see that we will never suffer France or any other power to tamper with our interior. If that is not the object, there can be no reason for declining an accommodation to the whole of our demands. The incumbent minister to France, Robert R. Livingston, had meanwhile learned much in a drawing-room gathering in Paris hosted by Josephine Bonaparte. According to custom, Madame Bonaparte entered first, and Napoleon followed her, making conversation first with the ladies on hand and then with the men. When the first consul has gone the round of one room, he turned to me and made some of those common questions usual on such occasions, Livingston told Jefferson. A moment later, Napoleon moved toward Lord Whitworth, the British envoy, and Livingston said, accosted Lord Whitworth with some warmth, told him that there would probably be a storm. It was a public declaration of what Lord Whitworth had been told in private 2 days earlier. If you do not evacuate Malta, there will be war. Napoleon then suddenly withdrew altogether after roiling European diplomacy in a drawing room. You may easily surmise the sensation that this excited, Livingston said. Two expresses were dispatched to England that very night, and I dare say to every court in Europe in the course of the next day. Livingston interpreted the incident in the same way everyone else did, as a sign of Napoleon's intention to go to war with England. And that possibility increased the chances that France might want to simplify its North American problems by putting Louisiana in the hands of the United States. For France, holding and defending land so far from Europe was growing too expensive and troublesome. The defeat at the hands of slave forces in Saint-Domingue was especially galling to Napoleon, who believed he needed to husband his resources for campaigns closer to home. Napoleon was in his bath, soaking in cologne-scented water, when his brothers came in to protest the decision to sell Louisiana. "You will have no need to lead the opposition," Napoleon told his brothers, "for I repeat, there will be no debate, for the reason that the project conceived by me, negotiated by me, shall be ratified and executed by me alone. Do you comprehend me?" "I renounce Louisiana," Napoleon announced to Finance Minister Barbe Marbois early on the morning of Monday, April 11, 1803. Within hours, Foreign Minister Charles Maurice de Talleyrand was inquiring whether the United States would be interested in the entire territory. "It is not only New Orleans that I will cede, it is the whole colony without any reservation. I know the price of what I abandon. I renounce it with the greatest regret, but to attempt obstinately to retain it would be folly." Livingston knew what he had to do. "The field open to us is infinitely larger than our instructions contemplated," Livingston told Madison, "and the chance must not be missed." He and Monroe, who had arrived in Paris, negotiated a treaty giving the United States the Louisiana Territory, a landmass so vast the borders were unclear even to the buyers and the sellers, for about $15 million, or 3 cents an acre. Word reached Jefferson on Sunday evening, July 3, 1803. Rufus King had arrived in New York and dispatched a packet to Washington. The key document was a letter from Livingston and Monroe announcing that they had signed a treaty with France on April 30th, ceding to us the island of New Orleans and all Louisiana as it had been held by Spain. Jefferson wrote Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. from Washington on Tuesday, July 5th. "The price is not mentioned." Jefferson was stunned, happily stunned, but stunned nonetheless. Reading the correspondence in the President's house, he slowly grasped the scope of the news. "It is something larger than the whole U.S., probably containing 500 millions of acres. The U.S. containing 434 millions, he wrote, seemingly thinking aloud as his mind took in what had happened. "This removes from us the greatest source of danger to our peace." It was wondrous. It must strike the mind of every true friend of freedom in the United States as the greatest and most beneficial event that has taken place since the Declaration of Independence, wrote Horatio Gates on Thursday, July 7th. "I am astonished when I see so great a business finished, which but a few months since we whispered to one another about. It has the air of enchantment. Every face wears a smile, and every heart leaps with joy," Andrew Jackson wrote Jefferson from the West. "The thing is new in the annals of the world," wrote another correspondent. "The great matter now is to make the wonderful event a blessing to the human race." As Jefferson absorbed the news, he wrote Meriwether Lewis, who left Washington on that Tuesday, July 5, 1803, to begin the expedition Jefferson described as "the journey which you are about to undertake for the discovery of the course and source of the Mississippi, and of the most convenient water communication from thence to the Pacific." It was the letter of a president at once optimistic and realistic. He hoped Lewis would reach the Pacific and armed the party with the means necessary to return home, come what may, authorizing Lewis to draw on the credit of the United States if necessary. Jefferson had now done all he could to control the largely uncontrollable nature of the mission that was to take Lewis, Clark and their party of 40 or so up the Missouri River, into the winter of present-day North Dakota, then along the Columbia River to the Pacific. Jefferson had written detailed instructions, offered counsel, and worried over details. At last it was in the hands of the explorers, and Jefferson waited eagerly for word from the fields he long traveled in his mind. The 4th of July fell on Monday. The president's house was filled with festive callers. Samuel Harrison Smith thought there were more visitors than usual. The party was abuzz with the Louisiana news, and enlivened too by the presence of between 40 and 50 ladies clothed in their best attire. Cakes, punch, wine, etc., in profusion, Smith wrote. In the flush of success, Jefferson was sanguine about everything, even the fate of the Union. "The future inhabitants of the Atlantic and Mississippi states will be our sons," Jefferson wrote John Breckinridge. "We leave them in distinct but bordering establishments. We think we see their happiness in their union, and we wish it. Events may prove it otherwise, and if they see their interest in separation, why should we take side with our Atlantic rather than our Mississippi descendants? It is the elder and the younger son differing. God bless them both and keep them in union, if it be for their good, but separate them, if it be better." To Joseph Priestley, he boasted of his diplomatic subtlety. "I very early saw that Louisiana was indeed a speck in our horizon, which was to burst in a tornado, and the public are unapprised how near this catastrophe was. Nothing but a frank and friendly development of causes and effects on our part, and good sense enough in Bonaparte to see that the train was unavoidable, and would change the face of the world, saved us from that storm." He closed the letter with a scholarly query. "Have you seen the new work of Malthus on population? It is one of the ablest I have ever seen." How like Jefferson. Amid the greatest of possible events affecting every aspect of American life and beyond, he was reading Malthus. The treaty had to be ratified by Sunday, October 30, 1803. Jefferson consulted with the cabinet and called for Congress to meet on Monday, October 17, 1803, to consider what he called great and weighty matters. Jefferson's initial view was that purchasing Louisiana and then governing it required a constitutional amendment. To John Breckinridge, he wrote, "This treaty must, of course, be laid before both houses, because both have important functions to exercise respecting it. They, I presume, will see their duty to their country in ratifying and paying for it, so as to secure a good which would otherwise probably be never again in their person. But I suppose they must then appeal to the nation for an additional article to the Constitution, approving and confirming an act which the nation had not previously authorized." What he had done thus far by allowing his representatives to negotiate and sign the treaty with France was, in his current view, beyond the scope of his powers. The executive, in seizing the fugitive occurrence, which so much advanced the good of their country, have done an act beyond the Constitution. The legislature, in casting behind them metaphysical subtleties, and risking themselves like faithful servants, must ratify and pay for it, and throw themselves on their country for doing for them, unauthorized, what we know they would have done for themselves had they been in a situation to do it. He used a lawyerly analogy to underscore his point. It is the case of a guardian investing the money of his ward in purchasing an important adjacent territory, and saying to him, when of age, "I did this for your good. I pretend to no right to bind you. You may disavow me, and I must get out of the scrape as I can. I thought it my duty to risk myself for you." Jefferson's opinion in the second week of August, 1803, then, was that the laborious machinery of amendment was crucial to ratify the purchase. 6 days after writing Breckinridge, though, Jefferson hurriedly wrote him again, essentially calling back the point. "I wrote you on the 12th instant on the subject of Louisiana and the constitutional provision which might be necessary for it," he wrote on Thursday, August 18th. "A letter received yesterday shows that nothing must be said on that subject which may give a pretext for retracting, but that we should do sub silencio what shall be found necessary. Be so good, therefore, as to consider that part of my letter as confidential. It strengthens the reasons for desiring the presence of every friend to the treaty on the first day of the session." The unwelcome letter received on Wednesday, August 17th, had come from Paris. Reporting from the French capital, Livingston and Monroe warned that France was growing uncomfortable with the deal. Fearing trouble, Jefferson moved decisively, pressing for a fast congressional vote in October and changing his mind about the need for a constitutional amendment. You will find that the French government, dissatisfied perhaps with their late bargain with us, will be glad of a pretext to declare it void, Jefferson wrote Gallatin on Tuesday, August 23, 1803. It will be necessary, therefore, that we execute it with punctuality and without delay. Speed was essential. Whatever Congress shall think it necessary to do should be done with as little debate as possible, and particularly so far as respects the constitutional difficulty, Jefferson wrote Senator Wilson Carey Nicholas of Virginia from Monticello on Wednesday, September 7th. Attorney General Levi Lincoln worried that there could be opposition to an acquisition, which was all the more reason for Jefferson to move quickly and unilaterally. Is there not danger that the eastern states, including even Rhode Island and Vermont, if not New York, and other states further south, would object to the ratification of a treaty directly introducing a state of things, involving the idea of adding to the weight of the southern states in one branch of the government, of which there is already too great a jealousy and dread? No plea of necessity, of commercial utility, or national security will have weight with a violent party, or be any security against their hostile efforts and opposition clamor. Thomas Paine suggested an extraordinary scenario to Jefferson on Friday, September 23, 1803. What if Napoleon successfully defeated and subjugated England? The English government is but in a tottering condition, and if Bonaparte succeeds, the government will break up, Paine wrote Jefferson. In that case, it is not improbable we may obtain Canada, and I think that Bermuda ought to belong to the United States. Paine mused about Bonaparte's war plans for England, too. The First Consul, Paine said, had only to choose a dark night and a calm to land along the North Sea coast. Paine's implied point, with such momentous things afoot, it was foolish to worry over constitutional niceties. Alexander Hamilton could not have put it better. The philosophical Jefferson had believed an amendment necessary. The political Jefferson, however, was not going to allow theory to get in the way of reality. I confess I think it important in the present case to set an example against broad construction by appealing for new power to the people, he wrote Wilson Carey Nicholas. If, however, our friends shall think differently, certainly I shall acquiesce with satisfaction, confiding that the good sense of our country will correct the evil of construction when it shall produce ill effects. So he left himself room to maneuver. It was the same kind of political craft he had practiced in the debate over the Bank of the United States, when he made the case against Hamilton's broad construction only to, wisely, leave open the possibility that Washington could sign the bill. Jefferson's decision to acquire Louisiana without seeking a constitutional amendment expanded the powers of the executive in ways that would likely have driven Jefferson to distraction had another man been president. Much of his political life, though, had been devoted to the study and the wise exercise of power. He did what had to be done to preserve the possibility of republicanism and progress. Things were neat only in theory, and despite his love of ideas and image of himself, Thomas Jefferson was as much a man of action as he was of theory. Indian tribes knew this well, though he would not live to see the Trail of Tears of the 1830s. Jefferson was among the architects of Indian removal. He eagerly acquired lands from the tribes throughout the American interior, up to 200,000 square miles, and as in the case of the Louisiana Purchase, did all he could to encourage white settlement ever further west and south. In 1803, writing to William Henry Harrison, then governor of the Indiana Territory, Jefferson said that he believed the Indians will in time either incorporate with us as citizens of the United States or remove beyond the Mississippi. He threatened to retaliate against any attacking tribes by seizing the whole country of that tribe and driving them across the Mississippi as the only condition of peace. Jefferson was triumphant on every front. Our business is to march straight forward to the object which has occupied us for 28 years, without either turning to the right or left, Jefferson wrote former New York Governor George Clinton on New Year's Eve, 1803. In the hour of death, we shall have the consolation to see established in the land of our fathers the the most wonderful work of wisdom and disinterested patriotism that has ever yet appeared on the globe. To his opponents, Jefferson's success seemed insurmountable and unendurable. The Republicans have, as I expected, done more to strengthen the executive than Federalists dared think of even in Washington's day, Gouverneur Morris wrote to Roger Griswold in November 1803. In January 1804, the Federalist Timothy Pickering, now a senator from Massachusetts, suggested secession and the formation of a Northern Confederacy. If, I say, Federalism is crumbling away in New England, there is no time to be lost, lest it should be overwhelmed and become unable to attempt its own relief, he said. New York would be essential. If the project, what Griswold euphemistically called a reunion of the Northern states, were to succeed. The people of the East cannot reconcile their habits, views, and interests with those of the South and West, said Pickering. The latter are beginning to rule with a rod of iron. The opposition was more than a little desperate. Many persons are at this moment prepared to declare Jefferson president for life, Griswold wrote on Tuesday, January 10, 1804. Which was what the Federalists feared most. Chapter 36. The people were never more happy. If we can keep the vessel of state as steadily in her course for another 4 years, my earthly purposes will be accomplished. Thomas Jefferson. I think you ought to get a damn kicking, you red-headed son of a bitch. You are a pretty fellow to be President of the United States of America, you dirty scoundrel. Anonymous. On most afternoons, when he was in Washington, Jefferson received his dinner guests at the President's house around 3:30 or 4 o'clock. He entertained constantly, handsomely, and with a purpose. His instinct to open his house and table was natural, something he had learned growing up as a son of the world of Virginia hospitality. Jefferson believed, too, that sociability was essential to republicanism. Men who liked and respected and enjoyed one another were more likely to cultivate the virtuous habits that would enable the country's citizens to engage in the pursuit of happiness. An affectionate man living in harmony with his neighbors was more likely to understand the mutual sacrifice of opinion of which Jefferson had spoken, and to make those sacrifices. There was, of course, a more immediate point to frequent gatherings of lawmakers, diplomats, and cabinet officers at the president's table. It tends to be more difficult to oppose, or at least to vilify, someone with whom you have broken bread and drunk wine. Caricatures crack as courses are served. Imagined demonic plots fade with dessert. Jefferson understood this, but he was ruthless about the use of his limited time in power. To create an ethos of suprapartisan civility would have required bringing politicians of opposing views together under his aegis. Jefferson disliked confrontation so much, however, that he forewent inviting Republicans and Federalists to dine together with him. He had only 4 or 8 years to impress himself on the country, and was unwilling to waste any of those hours presiding over arguments, even polite ones, between differing factions at his table. The possibilities of conflict in a setting designed to promote comity were too great. Jefferson chose, then, to use dinner at the president's house partly as a means of weaving attachments to him. It was his stage and his production. He ended the more formal arrangements common to Presidents Washington and Adams, forbidding seating by precedence. He preferred pell-mell, or the more democratic practice of having guests sit where they chose, and the drinking of toasts to one's health. A tedious custom he replaced with more free-flowing, eclectic conversation. Like his aristocratic habit of dressing as though he were at Monticello rather than the Capitol, with his old slippers, which made such an impression on so many, the gentle creation of disorder at dinner magnified his own strengths as a conversationalist. The architect Benjamin H. Latrobe reveled in his first dinner at the president's house. The food, Latrobe wrote his wife, was excellent, cooked rather in the French style, larded venison. The dessert was profuse and extremely elegant, and the knick-knacks, after withdrawing the cloths, profuse and numberless. Wine in great variety, from sherry to champagne, and a few decanters of rare Spanish wine. At first, Jefferson hung back, playing the host, then joined the stream of talk brilliantly. Latrobe loved it all. "It is a long time since I have been present at so elegant a mental treat," he said. "Literature, wit, and a little business, with a great deal of miscellaneous remarks on agriculture and building, filled every minute. There is a degree of ease in Mr. Jefferson's company that everyone seems to feel and to enjoy." Jefferson had a conservationist's turn of mind, and once mused on the subject of the rapidly depleting number of trees along the sides of Capitol Hill, and on the banks of the Potomac and the Anacostia rivers. Such as grew on the public grounds ought to have been preserved, but in a government such as ours, where the people are sovereign, this could not be done, Margaret Bayard Smith recalled. The people, the poorer inhabitants, cut down these noble and beautiful trees for fuel. Others felled trees for profit. "How I wish that I possessed the power of a despot," Jefferson said one day, surprising his guests. "Yes," he went on, "I wish I was a despot that I might save the noble, the beautiful trees that are daily falling sacrifices to the cupidity of their owners or the necessity of the poor." A guest asked, "And have you not authority to save those on the public grounds?" "No," said Jefferson. "Only an armed guard could save them. The unnecessary felling of a tree, perhaps the growth of centuries, seems to me a crime little short of murder, and it pains me to an unspeakable degree." Jefferson's social civility softened the more strident hours of partisanship. The Federalist Senator William Plumer of New Hampshire had begun his Washington career with a predictably harsh view of Jefferson. Early in the decade of the 1800s, Plumer dismissed the president as the leader of a feeble, nerveless administration, later adding, "I did think he had great talents, wisdom, and a portion of those virtues that render a man amiable and useful, but craft and cunning are as distant from wisdom as meanness is from economy, or his views from true greatness." As the years passed, Plumer's opinion of Jefferson, formed at close quarters as a guest in the president's house, evolved from hostility to one of partial respect. "The more critically and impartially I examine the character and conduct of Mr. Jefferson, the more favorably I think of his integrity," Plumer wrote in 1806. The senator still disagreed strongly with the president on policy, but Jefferson's grace and hospitality did its work. "I have a curiosity which is gratified by seeing and conversing with Jefferson," Plumer wrote. "I gain a more thorough knowledge of his character and of his views, and those of his party, for he is naturally communicative." At the president's house, Jefferson gave Plumer some pecans to cultivate, and the two men engaged in the most chivalrous of exchanges. "After 20 years, they will bear," Jefferson said. "I shall, then, despair of eating of them," Plumer said. "Your children will eat with pleasure the fruit of your industry," said Jefferson. "I will teach them to bear in remembrance to whose politeness they are indebted for the nuts that produce these trees of fruit," replied Plumer. Jefferson left no guest behind. Struggling to make small talk with the president, the wife of the mayor of Georgetown could remember only that she had heard of Carter's Mountain, the redoubt where Jefferson was alleged to have run away from the British in 1781. Unaware of the trauma and embarrassment evoked by even the mention of the place, she asked Jefferson if he lived near Carter's Mountain. "Very close," he said. "It is the adjoining mountain to Monticello." "I suppose it is a very convenient, pleasant place," the wife said, plunging on unknowingly as her husband sat awkwardly powerless to stop her. Jefferson maintained his poise, replying simply, "Why, yes, I certainly found it so in the wartime." There the subject was dropped. At dinner, late on another afternoon, the table talk was dominated by a few men whom Mrs. Smith, who was also there, described as distinguished persons. The conversation was earnest and animated, but one guest, who had lived in Europe for a time, sat silent and unnoticed, apparently feeling overwhelmed by the high-powered company. He began thinking himself a stranger in his own country, who was totally unknown to the present company. Then the President of the United States fixed his attention on the returning American. "To you, Mr. Cutting, we are indebted, and no one more deserves the gratitude of his country." The chatter stopped. The Capitol crowd at the table was startled by this presidential praise, and suddenly attention warmed the long-ignored guest. "Yes, sir," Jefferson went on. "The Upland rice, which you sent from Algiers, and which thus far succeeds, will, when generally adopted by the planters, prove an inestimable blessing to our southern states." With a stroke of grace, Jefferson had transformed an unnoticed guest into what Mrs. Smith called a person of importance, and the president fulfilled the most fundamental duty of a host. He showed respect to those under his roof, making them feel comfortable and cared for. To Jefferson, each guest who came into his orbit was significant, and he had little patience, no patience, in fact, with the trappings of rank. His blend of politics, Republican simplicity, and haute cuisine was not universally popular. Anthony Mary, the new minister from Britain, found that his and Jefferson's ideas of the deference due a representative of George III were difficult to reconcile. The president's reception of the new envoy passed without incident. Not so the dinner to which Mary and his wife were invited at the president's house. Mrs. Madison was the hostess for the evening, and Jefferson took her into dinner. The Marys ended up in what they believed to be inferior seats at the table. Thus began a small but pitched social and diplomatic battle in the drawing and dining rooms of Washington. The Mary faction included the family of the Spanish minister, who also favored more ceremony and nicety. Mrs. Mary, Jefferson said, was a virago, and in the short course of a few weeks has established a degree of dislike among all classes which one would have thought impossible in so short a time. It was the old world versus the new, and on Jefferson's watch, the new was to win. We say to them, no. The principle of society with us, as well as of our political constitution, is the equal rights of all, and if there be an occasion where this equality ought to prevail preeminently, it is in the social circles collected for conviviality, Jefferson wrote in January 1804. There was a specific political element to the tempest. The British representatives, Jefferson said, thought that we are not as friendly now to Great Britain as before our acquisition of Louisiana. Jefferson denied it. This is totally without foundation. Our friendship to that nation is cordial and sincere. So is that with France. We consider each as a necessary instrument